and welcome to David's Book Talk. Today we have a special author guest. His name is Dana Haynes. He has written two thrillers about airplane crashes. This new one's called Breaking Point. It's just out recently from Minotaur Books. This is his second novel, with Minotaur anyway, and he's here to join us. Hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, how's it going?
Everything's going great here in Portland, Oregon.
Now, I didn't realize you had written a mystery series back in the 90s. I'm just finding this out. I'm doing some research, and you wrote a mystery series in the 90s?
I did. I wrote three books that were published in the States by Bantam and one that was published in England by Severn House, and they were straight-up murder mysteries, academic setting murder mysteries, and they were written under the name Conrad Haynes instead of my real name, Dana.
Right. So your real name is Dana?
It is, yeah.
Where does the Conrad come from?
I was a working journalist at the time, and I thought, foolishly, because I was young, that it would be a good idea to write fiction under a pseudonym so that people, when they see me coming in my role as a journalist, wouldn't mistake what I did between my fiction and my nonfiction writing. So that was a family name that I picked up, and I thought, that seems like a good idea. And now, years later, I think, well, boy, that was really dumb.
You're probably related to Joseph Conrad, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's where all the writing ability comes in, right?
It was either that or Jane Eyre. I really went between the two of them.
Right. All right, Breaking Point. I mean, I really like this book. I mean, and I liked it even better than I like Crashers. I think.
Oh my gosh.
I think you're growing as a writer quite nicely.
Well, that's wonderful to hear because every writer fears the sophomore slump. You write one book that you're very excited about, and the publisher, God willing, says I'd like the sequel. And you fear that you can't make lightning strike a second time. So I worked really hard to make the second book shine. It was a labor, but it was a labor of love too. I mean, I really liked this character.
You can see the difference between the first and the second one. And I liked Crashers. I had a little more trouble understanding what was going on in Crashers for some reason. I don't know why. Maybe it's the technical stuff, but it's much, much clearer in Breaking Point. Much more.
Oh, that's great to hear.
Much more thrilling and exciting to read, you know, page-turning for sure, and that's what I like in this book. I mean, the whole idea of a plane crash and the aftermath and trying to figure out what happened to the plane, it's just fascinating to me. I still remember Michael Crichton's Airframe book when that came out.
Sure, of course.
And I had this picture of all these airplane parts laying on the ground in that book. It's amazing what goes through your head, and I mean, that it sticks with you for some reason.
Well, interestingly enough, I don't think I was influenced by Airframe, but I was really influenced by Michael Crichton's The Andromeda Strain. I probably read that when I was 20. And like that, it's a book with an ensemble cast of scientists and engineers who use smarts and their government work in order to try and solve a mystery. And I read it when I was 19 or 20, and I went back about a year and a half ago and read it again, and it held up. It held up greatly. And I realized that idea of that ensemble cast of investigative scientists was a strong influence on me.
Right. And it's, of course, it's a classic now, the Andromeda.
Oh, yeah.
I saw the remake movie of that, and it really was kind of frightening. So they really...
It was, yeah.
I remember the guy from Will and Grace was in. It was kind of... I just remember being very disturbed by it for some reason. I have not seen the original movie version of it. I know Arthur Hill's in it. I know it's one of my mom's favorite movies. But I've never seen it from beginning to end. I don't know why. I think the idea of a virus running around killing people scares me a little bit.
Well, it should.
The fact, of course, in movies, you get things faster than you do in real life. I think of that movie Contagion that's coming out on video soon, and that whole idea just scares me that you could get sick and die from somebody else.
Well, Contagion is a very good film, and I highly recommend it for your listeners. It was an excellent ensemble cast and a really great script.
Now, what exactly are crashers? Now, this is the term why have I never heard that term crashers before I read your books?
It is a real term. The people from the National Transportation Safety Board who investigate airline crashes refer to themselves colloquially as crashers.
How long have they been doing that? I mean, has that been going on a long time that they've called themselves crashers, or is it just recently?
The very first time I ever ran upon the term was about 1992. So it's been a while, I know. And I first became intrigued by them after a famous crash writer on 92 in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh, outside of Pittsburgh, in which a U.S. air jetliner tumbled straight down into the ground at full throttle, and the NTSB was called in to investigate it. And I thought, you know, the work they did was fascinating, and so I began studying who they are and how they get to do what they do and why they do what they do. And I thought, boy, somebody's going to write a great novel about these folks. And time passed and time passed, and nobody did. And finally I thought, gosh darn it, I'm going to have to write this darn thing.
Why do you think nobody did, I wonder? I mean, what a great idea for a novel.
Well, there's two or three answers. One is other writers are much smarter than I am and realize this is really a big thing to chew on. This is a very complicated story with lots of moving pieces. And I think other writers thought, well, let some idiot try and write this one. But another joking aspect of that, too, and my friends at Minotaur have laughed about this, too, is that, you know, where do people buy hardback books? Well, a lot of them buy them at airports. So it's one of those topics that maybe I didn't think thoroughly through.
Right.
But it is, it's one of those books that if you are afraid of research or you don't want to do a lot of technical writing, I can see where a lot of writers would veer away from it. But I spent 20 years in newsrooms, newspaper newsrooms, and was very excited about the research and had a great deal of fun doing it. Now, grant you, it took me a year to do the research, but it might have scared off some other writers who thought about the genre.
But reading your books, they immediately think, you know, this guy's really smart. There's so much technical stuff in here. How does he know all this stuff? And what is this all really real? And of course, now that you say that you were researching it for a year, I'm sure it's as close as you, I mean, I'm sure it's been thoroughly researched, and everything in the book is researched. Did this kind of a crash really happen in Breaking Point?
The crashes that I refer to in these two books are completely fictional, and the.
So you can't base them on it. You can't base them on a real something that really happened.
No, I wouldn't, because if there had been a real crash, then there would be real survivors and, you know, real mourners and loved ones, and I would feel terrible about trying to write a fictional account of somebody who actually lost a loved one or their own life.
When I see airplane disaster movies on TV, and I used to watch all the airport movies when I was a kid. The Airport 75 and all those other ones that came after it. And I used to think, boy, to survive something like this, this would be something you'd talk about for the rest of your life. It would just be something you would never forget, and you would never let anybody around you forget it either, because it would just be so exciting to talk about.
You'd think so, yeah, you would. Yeah, absolutely.
And now with that that Italian liner turning over, I mean, all these disasters are happening. I mean, I have a picture in my head of that liner laying on its side. And it's so horrifying even to think about, and then comparing it to the Titanic. And I mean, what would it be like to be in a disaster, to be in something like this and have a plane crash on you? You can't imagine the horror of it.
Well, it's one of those factors, if you're going to write a thriller of this nature, that you do have to think about, because for the grand majority of readers, it should be an exciting, action-packed romp. But there are going to be some people that you step on their own personal lives. People are going to say, oh, I lost a loved one, or I was in one of these. And you do have to worry that you're stepping into some traumatic zone for some readers. Then again, every work of fiction, the writer and the reader bring their own luggage together, and that's just one of those things you learn to be sensitive about, but you have to acknowledge it's going to happen.
I just today I was talking to somebody who came into the bookstore and I was trying to sell her a novel, and she, when she realized it was had a lot of vigilante themes in it, she didn't really want anything to do with it. Readers are very sensitive to the themes of books, and if it's something they don't like, it's going to be a real hard sell. So you do have to think about that. I mean, it's something that, I mean, as a writer, you should have a freedom to write whatever you want to write, but knowing also that if you pick a sensitive theme, your book may not sell.
Well, also, you're going to live as a writer. You're going to live with this story for a certain amount of time, perhaps a year, perhaps more. And so if it's a really uncomfortable topic, my good friend, Portland author Chelsea Kane, writes psychosexual mystery thrillers.
I've read them. I still haven't recovered from them.
I think she's wonderful. I think she's terrific, and she's just a great friend. But I've often told her, I wouldn't want to live with that story for a year while you're doing the research and you're, you know, putting together the plot, putting together the setting. I wouldn't want that to be front and center in my brain. So thank goodness she's writing them, because Lord knows I wouldn't want to do it.
Yeah, that whole scene in one of her books where Gretchen is operating on Archie is quite graphic to read. I still remember that scene. It's something that I'll never forget.
And it's hard to imagine that Chelsea's like the sweetheart of all time, and she's got this really cute little daughter and a lovely husband, and you think, well, where do these twisted stories come from?
Right. And in your book, in Breaking Point, there's a really nasty villain who, I don't want to give too much away, but he's able to get to the crash site and do some stuff that, you know, and it's quite horrifying to think that it would be that easy to be able to do that. I mean, just to be able to infiltrate, you know, something that's so, you know, and nobody would know. And it's horrifying to think about, and how easy it would be. I doubt that it's very difficult for them to.
Well, when an actual crash happens, the security protocols in the first hours or days are tend to be quite loose, because the first people to show up are the first responders to look for survivors, and the second people to show up are the NTSB crashers who need to secure the site, and then the third people show up are law enforcement, traditionally. And law enforcement quite often arrives and discovers much of the scene has been, if you will forgive the term, contaminated by the first two groups. And so that was one of the themes I played with early on in constructing Breaking Point, was a crime scene that is, for all intents and purposes, a very public venue with lots of folks walking about and contaminating the evidence.
Yeah, and the whole book is fascinating. I mean, as we go from them trying to figure out what really happened and what's happening to the people who are invested, the crashers, and you know, it's just fascinating to read. You don't know what's coming next, and that's what I like about it. And you get these vivid pictures in your mind of the plane crash, and I think of that series Lost, the very opening episode with the plane crash, and you know, and it's. And all the people screaming, and then there's fire everywhere, and people are trying to find each other, and they're stuck on this island. And it's very vivid in your mind. Scenes like that in movies and books, you know, stay with you for a long time.
Yes, they do. They can.
If you do, look at how Hannibal Lecter stays with us. I mean, who's ever going to forget that character?
Right, exactly. Excellent thought. Yeah, that's
And now we're
superbly portrayed in the book, and then in the first couple of movies.
And now they're going to make a TV series out of Hannibal Lecter. It's really going to be interesting. So I just read that recently. They're going to make a TV series, which should be interesting to watch. I don't know how they're ever going to find anybody as good as Anthony Hopkins for the role. But,
yeah, exactly.
I mean, nobody else should play Hannibal Lecter in my book. But now you had your first crash, which was going to be published in 2001, and then we had, of course, 9/11, so it wasn't published. So you were sitting on crash for quite a while.
Yes, the research was in 1999, the writing was in 2000, and I got an agent in 2001, in August of 2001, who said, gosh, this is a terrific book, I love this book, I'm pretty sure I can sell this book. And about 30 days later was September 11th, 2001, in which terrorists, and my book was about terrorists bringing down multiple airliners. It goes without saying that my book became instantly unmarketable. There was just absolutely no way, in good faith, we could even attempt to find a publisher after that.
Right.
So we did put it on a shelf and waited, you know, 6 or 7 years until we thought the time was right and dragged it back out. In the meantime, I kept writing. I kept trying to find other books I could, you know, other stories I could tell. I trained myself on how to be a screenwriter. I adapted Crashers into a screenplay and made it to the semifinals of a big contest in Hollywood. And then I just knew it was a really good story, and I had to wait until the timing was right. So reintroduced it to try to find a new agent in about 2008, 2009, and found my agent. And then she connected me with my editor, the great Keith Kayla at Minotaur Books, and the rest is history.
Right. So it, as of right now, it will not be a movie.
Well, now I would love to see it be a movie. I would absolutely.
Is there still a chance of that? I guess there's always a chance of that.
Absolutely, yeah, and I would pursue that with all my strength. But on the other hand, I have a book that's out, and it's my dream to be a novelist. And so, if it did happen, it would be pure gravy. And so, I'm not holding my breath, waiting for it to happen. But if it happened, I'd be doing handstands.
Right. So you're going to write thrillers now. In the meanwhile, until I mean, this is your new career.
Well, St. Martin's was happy enough with the first two books that they asked me if one of the protagonists from Crashers and Breaking Point, the character of Daria, might have her own stand-up breakout novel. And I submitted a story about her. Now, you'll recall she's the ex-Israeli spy.
Okay.
It's involved with those crashes. And so, sure enough, I wrote a half a novel about her and submitted it to St. Martin's. And they were, and forgive me for your listeners, Minotaur is the mystery and thriller subset of St. Martin's.
And they have
submitted that story. Right.
And they were
very, very happy with it, and they've asked for two books, two thrillers starring the character Daria Gibran.
Is that okay with you? I mean, obviously, you want to be published, but I mean, is that what did you intend to write books with her in them?
Let me put it to you this way: I have more fun writing scenes in which she's in than any other character. She virtually writes her own scenes, and some days, some of the best scenes I've written are the ones in which I get out of the way and just let her write them herself. She's such a dynamic character, and she's so fun to write. That,
of course, you don't know anybody like her at all.
No. And thank goodness. She's pretty crazy, but she's my gosh, when Keith, my editor at Minotaur, said he'd like to see her as a standout, breakout protagonist, I was thrilled. So I'm having a great deal of fun. I just submitted the first draft of the first Daria novel to them a couple of weeks ago, so we'll see where that's going.
We can't even say the title yet, can we?
No, we just got a working title of Daria 1.
I mean, I don't know about anybody else, but I love to hear upcoming titles, but I guess we're going to have to wait for that one. Daria 1.
I jokingly told Minotaur I wanted to call it Thin Thighs in 30 Days, but their lawyers didn't think that was funny.
No, I don't think they'd like that. Well, it's interesting, the rope on the cover of Breaking Point, I said that was in there with the seal. I guess, is that the United States seal in the background?
It is an American seal, but it's a replica of a seal that's on the hardback of Crashers. So it's just an image echo from the first novel. So it's not an official seal of any kind. It's just a pretty groovy little logo.
Obviously, you like to tell these stories, and the grittier the better.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I mean, and as an author, I mean, it's fun, actually. I mean, like you said with Daria, creating these evil characters and doing these evil things in books, it's got to be a lot of fun.
Well, I often say when I'm teaching classes or when I'm teaching workshops that the very first reader, the first reader that you really need to grab and make sure that reader is having a great deal of fun is you, the author. You ought to think to yourself, oh, I can't wait to get home from work because I really want to get to Act 7 or, you know, Chapter 14. It's going to be so much fun. I can't wait. I've got the idea in my head of where it's going to go. And if you, as a thriller writer, as a genre writer, if you ever find yourself thinking, oh, gosh, I got to go home and clean the cat box and make dinner and write Chapter 7, well, you're in trouble because you're as little fun as the writing is, that will reflect, I think, for the readers. So, yeah, my first reader is me, and my first mission is to write stories that just tickle me, that just I'm having a great deal of fun jumping into.
Now,
if I find that I'm doing it, then I'm hoping that the readers will.
Now, does your editor get to read it as you write it? I mean, do you send it to him, and does he... I mean, do you get somebody's... I guess what I'm asking you is, do you get somebody's opinion in the process of writing to make sure that somebody thinks it's good?
Or well, is traditionally, it... what I've done is submitted entire manuscripts to Minotaur. So I write the first most important words, which are the end, before I send it to them. But in the instance of the first of the Daria breakout books, I did send them the first 150 pages and asked, is this what you're thinking about? And they wrote back and said, yeah, absolutely, go for it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. It's great to hear that. As a reader, you like to hear about the process of writing. I mean, you read a book and you think, oh, I could write a book like that, but you know, sit down and try it yourself sometime. It's not that easy.
I mean, you can't. Probably not.
And you really can't. You can't cut corners. You have to really explain things. People want to know things, you know. And I always thought to myself, well, you know, I watch movies today, and I think to myself, but these characters are not fleshed out enough, and that really annoys me. Uh-huh. Even though you can watch a two-hour movie, you know, you don't really a lot of times get the character fleshed out. That's why I want to see that movie, The Descendants. That sounds like they do a good job with that one. But, you know, there's some that, by the end of the movie, you're like, I still don't know anything about these characters. This is really annoying. So it's so important that we know as much as we can about the characters. We know their motivations. We know why they do things. We know why they are the way they are.
It's not an easy task, but you're absolutely right. That's the good writers find a way to do that.
And, you know, we're such an action society with movies and books. You know, we want action in the book. We want things to happen. But to me, if I don't get good, if the characters aren't believable, it ruins the book for me. That's how I feel. And I don't know. I assume you feel the same way. I mean, you've got to take these characters and make them real people. We've got to know.
No, absolutely.
Why is Daria like the way she is? She just didn't wake up evil one morning.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
And I think about Hannibal Lecter, I don't know. I've never really seen The Red Dragon, the beginning one, so I don't know the motivations behind what caused him to be the way he is. I mean, that in itself would make a great book. What causes people to be serial killers? And I'm sure there are books written about it somewhere. But I mean, what causes these people to be? It can't just be they suddenly are like that. You know, there has to be something. We have to know.
Yep.
And as readers, we want to know these things. You know, and it has to make sense. It has to be. We have to understand by the end of the book. You know, why this is. That's what makes Elizabeth George such a great writer. I mean, you know, by the end of the book, why everybody has done what they've done. And she's very careful that she gets all of that into the book. It may take her 700 pages, but she gets it done.
Well, it's not an easy task.
Can you imagine writing a 700-page book every time?
Gosh, that's why I have a good editor to make sure I don't write 700-page books.
You mean you could if you wanted to?
Oh, no. My stories come in more or less the same length, but I do believe strongly in the editing process, and I am, you know, I know that you've had guests on your show who said, oh, you know, you have bad editors, and you have to deal with editors, and the editors don't know what they're doing. That's not been my example at all. I've got a great, great editor, marvelous support from him. His ideas for making the books have made them better. So I'm a huge fan of the editing process. I'm not a fan of letting my first drafts ever see the light of day. I need a real strong editor to look at my stuff.
Who can say, Dana, that doesn't work, get rid of it.
Exactly, right.
That works,
girlfriend.
That doesn't, you know, and
yeah.
As long as they're not taking over the whole writing of the process, obviously you've got a control over it. I can tell by the way you're talking about it, but, you know, are there some editors, I wonder if there are some editors that just end up changing the book too much and angering the author.
You do hear those horror stories, but it just hasn't been my experience. I've been really, really lucky. My editor at Bantam was Kate Misiak, tremendous editor, and now I've got Keith at Minotaur, terrific editor. So my dad's a basketball coach, and he often says that it's good to be good, but better to be lucky. There's no question that I've had, benefited from a level of luck, too.
Now, the interesting thing is the cover on this book, I mean, you can almost feel, I don't know if this is supposed to be rope or wire, is it a wire on the cover or is it rope?
It's a cable.
It's a cable. Okay. So you can actually almost see the cable. It looks like it's actually coming out from the book. It's almost like a 3D kind of thing. It's kind of cool the way they did it.
Very nice. I agree with you. Absolutely.
But
marvelous stuff.
It makes me think about all those scenes in action movies where you see the rope starting to break, and I mean, it takes forever to break, and by that time,
right.
Of course, they've saved the person. But
exactly.
or the clock that counts down from 10 and then stays at 10 for the next 10 minutes. I mean, it's so hokey sometimes. It's ridiculous. It makes you so angry, but you know, because it just ruins the credibility sometimes. You have to sit there and laugh, and that's another thing that makes writing books like yours so difficult. Everything's got to gel. I mean, every little piece has to. By the end of the book, you have to feel like you know exactly why everything happened and why these things were happening. I mean, everything's got to make good sense. You can't just throw it all together at the end and say, "Well, this happened," and not explain why it happened.
Yeah, I often tell young writers or first time writers that they should try and write a outline of the story from the perspective of the bad guy. Make sure you know from the POV of the villain or the antagonist exactly how things came together. Because you can't do that. There's an excellent chance you can't obfuscate that. You can't hide it, too, because you just haven't really broken it down well enough. So it's one of those key elements for mystery writers is you ought to be able to tell the story from the bad guy's point of view. And if you can't, maybe it's time to reexamine your plot.
And interesting, and I wonder how, you know, a writer like P.D. James, who I think is in her close to her 90s now, and she's still writing books, and I always think to myself, well, how does she keep it all straight? Does she have somebody that works with her and helps her do that? I mean, at 90, how could you keep anything straight?
No kidding.
Your mind must...
I can find my car keys, I know.
I mean, at 40, you start forgetting things. I can't imagine what it's going to be like at 90. You know, and it's...
No kidding.
And I wonder, you know, how much, it makes me wonder how much the editor does. Does the editor keep that all together? Does the editor remember all these things? If you've made a mistake and name and put a name in wrong or a location in wrong, does the editor help you with that?
And there's no question in, I'm not 90, but I make those errors from time to time where we'll get the color of somebody's purse wrong or the type of gun somebody's carrying wrong. And sure enough, there are people at Minotaur, you know, copy editors will say, you know, that was a blue car in Chapter 7, and now it's green. And they're really good at catching that stuff.
That's cool. That's really cool that they have that. Well, I guess they would have to, or you know, the quality or the books wouldn't be what they want up to snuff. You know, you have to have something like that.
I'm thankful I'm with Minotaur. They're such a good house to work with.
Now, is every book you write difficult to write? I mean, was Breaking Point a little easier than Crashers?
Well, you have to remember that I lived with Crashers for a decade. So I had it for a long time in my head, and, you know, I had to put it on a shelf for 7 or 8 years. So it had to get changed, it had to get modified, and all of in the first draft there were a bunch of New York scenes, the LBM Los Angeles, the draft you saw.
Mm-hmm.
So that book was really difficult. When they said, gosh, we like Crashers, we want Crashers, can you do a sequel? I had only about a year to turn that one around. So that one I had to be very serious about just rolling up my sleeves and writing every single day and doing research every single day and making sure I kept the ball moving forward. And I think in some ways I benefited from the deadline. You remember, I'm a journalist, so I'm a newspaper guy, and I work best with deadlines.
Yeah.
And I think having a hard and fast deadline made that book better because it made me more disciplined.
Right, you have the experience. And 20 years as a journalist, you know what it's like to have a book done by a certain time,
right?
An article, in when you were when journalists being having an article, having to have an article done, having to think of. You know,
we used to joke. All the mystery writers that I know who are former journalists always joke about writer's block, because we just never had writer's block, because you go to a school board meeting or a city council meeting, and then you came back, and if you ever said to your editor, gosh, I'm just, you know, the muse isn't with me, and I'm not sure I can write that scene, they would just laugh and tell you, well, you have no choice, you've got to write it. So writer's block isn't one of those luxuries that we journalists ever had to deal with.
Well, is it easier to write the first line? I mean, when you sit down to first write a book, is it difficult to write that first sentence?
Yes, the first sentence is often very difficult, and I will go through many, many iterations of that first sentence and that first paragraph and the first scene, and I'll play with them, and I'll juggle them, and I'll throw stuff out. Literally will write them up on butcher paper in my kitchen on the cabinets, and so I can look at them in the morning while I'm making my coffee and ask myself, does this want to be my lead paragraph? And yeah, I struggle with those.
Now, you're not even a pilot. So one would say, well, this guy man's got to be a pilot. He obviously likes airplanes a lot. Why are you not a pilot?
That's a really good question. I would.
Yeah, why don't you answer?
I probably laziness is a part. I know that it's really difficult to get one's pilot's license, and it takes a lot of work. And I never had a fiscal motivation for being a pilot because I certainly can't afford to have an airplane, nor can I really ever afford to rent airplanes. And so if I had a license, it wouldn't really benefit me other than as a research tool. So I never pursued it. I have two friends who are flyers, and both of them said, you know, Dana, you really have to, you know, you do all this research, you got to get your pilot's license. To which I responded, well, I, you know, have many characters running around with guns, and I don't own a gun either. It's not.
So do you go to them a lot? Do you go to them a lot and say, I need help with this and this and this and this?
Yes, I have a real good friend who's an engineer at Portland International Airport who is very familiar with airplanes and the airline industry, and he's helped tremendously.
How safe are airplanes nowadays? I mean, how I mean, are we safer today than we were, say, 10, 15 years ago?
I'd say no question about it. As airplanes get more technical and they're more computer-oriented, there is necessarily an increase in the in how complicated they are. But while I never, ever had any fear of flying, I will tell you that what little iota of fear I used to have evaporated as I did the research. Because you soon realize how well-built these things are, how well-trained the engineers and the construction people are, and how well-trained the pilots are. I was doing an interview with a flying instructor who was talking about that airplane that floated into the Hudson River back about 2009.
So is that Captain Sullenberger's plane?
Right, yeah. Yes. And this guy had trained many pilots, and he said, well, that was a great job. The man did a terrific job. Captain Sullenberger did a wonderful job. But there's nobody I ever trained as a pilot who couldn't do that. That was what every good and decent pilot could do. So that's how well-trained our pilots are and the people who build these airplanes are, and they're just incredibly well-crafted. I often tell people that driving to Portland Airport scares the heck out of me. But once I'm on the airplane, I have no fear at all.
It's interesting, that show Pan Am that's on Sunday nights on Channel 6, I've tried to watch it. I think the problem with it is it's too soap operas for me. I'd rather see the things about the planes. I'd rather have a plane crash a week or something than to see the soap opera behind. I don't care who's sleeping with who. That it doesn't even matter to me. Unless the characters are interesting enough. And I think, you know, it's trying to take after. But I mean, do you watch those kind of shows, and are you fascinated by all those?
I don't. I'm not a big fan of the soap opera-esque drama. So those shows have never really appealed to me, and I let them go.
Right. There's a plane crash in the very beginning of this book. Now, why don't you, first of all, explain to people the plot of the book? We really haven't talked too much about the plot. We just mentioned it a little bit, but I want to hear in your words the basic plot of the book.
Well, there were a lot of protagonists in Crashers. There were, you know, 9 investigators. And when they told me they wanted a sequel, I thought, gosh, I've got to find a way to bring these characters back around. It's going to be difficult because, as normally would happen, if there was a crash one year, a whole bunch of crash investigators would get together. And if there was another crash the next year, it would be an entirely different set of investigators from the government. So I needed to find a way to bring them all back together. And the hook that I finally did with that was taking 3 of my protagonists from the first book and putting them in a crash. The plane they're in is the airplane that comes out of the sky. So that gave me, you know, sort of a central core of my first protagonists back together again. So in this book, 3 of my protagonists from Crashers are flying across country in a small propeller-driven commuter airplane, and it falls out of the sky. They survive, and while they are working on triage to, you know, try and save as many of their fellow crash victims as they can, the other investigators start coming together, and I've got characters from the first book plus characters that are brand new that I hear in this book. And I start bringing my cast of protagonists back together again through that mechanism.
Do you know in your mind all these different characters and how they are? I mean, if I mentioned, like, there's Tommy and there's all the other, do you know in your mind and you remember all the things that there is to know about them? I mean, there's some very quirky characters, which, of course, makes it even more fun to read. But, I mean, do you know in your mind all these characters? Do you remember it from book to book? Are you going to remember that from book to book?
No, I don't. I keep what I call a Bible with me. I work on a Macintosh computer, and if I do a major character and I say the character's eyes are blue or the character's 5'10" or the character drives a Miata, I will copy and paste that over into my little Bible to remind myself, yes, Tommy's 5'10", and Tommy has a hank of hair that hangs over his left eyebrow, and, you know, Tommy wears the Star of David, and Tommy wears cowboy boots, and I keep all that stuff in my head, actually in a file. So then when I get around to a scene and I want to describe something about that character, I go back to my Bible and remind myself what color is the clothing, and, you know, what color is the hair, and how tall is the person, the color of the eyes. Because, no, I don't keep all that stuff in my head.
Right.
What I do keep in my head is the voice of the characters. So if out of the clear blue, I wake up one morning and I think to myself, God, I really need to work on a scene in which I introduce blah, blah, blah. I can replicate or bring back the voice of Peter Kim or Susan Tanaka or Ray Calabrese pretty darn quick. because I have an oral memory of how they talk and how they hold themselves and how they present themselves and their dialect.
Yeah, Susan's pretty full of herself.
To say the least,
she's got an ego.
She's a great friend to write.
Yeah, I would think she's just an interesting character, and you get the feeling she's pretty much a know-it-all.
Yep.
But she really does seem to know her stuff anyway.
Well, and I wanted to do a very strong female protagonist who happens to wear designer clothes and 4-inch heels and, you know, dressed to the nines. So I don't think those two things can't necessarily have to be mutually exclusive in a thriller. Most times when you have a protagonist in a thriller, it's a hard-boiled, tough character. In this instance, possibly the toughest character, possibly the character with the most, who brings the most, muscle to the table, is the person who can talk to other bureaucracies, who can talk to other jurisdictions, who can stare down the FBI or stare down the whomever she needs to. So it was fun doing that as a character who also happens to look very feminine and to make her such a strong character. So she had a lot of fun.
Right. Now, you say you're working on the Daria books now. Are any of these characters from Crashers or Breaking Point going to appear in the Daria books?
Only briefly. These are not about airplane crashes, and they hardly take place. The first one doesn't take place that much in the United States. It's mostly overseas.
Oh, so you're saying the Daria books are not about airplanes?
They are not.
There we go. So you're not totally obsessed with airplanes?
No, I really wanted to do something different.
Not that I mind. I think it's fascinating, yeah. But I think it's interesting that you're going in another direction.
Thought I'd try something different, and so far they've been great fun.
There aren't a lot of airplane thrillers out there now. I know John, who was the guy who used to be on Good Morning America? He used to write them all a lot. I can't remember his name. He was a consultant. I can't think of his name right now. But he wrote all these airplane thrillers, which are really fascinating, but full of technical stuff out the... You know, you almost know a whole airplane by the time you're done reading one of his books. John something. I can't remember his name, but anyway... The point is, there aren't a lot of them out there.
Yes, I was very happy to stumble upon a story in which it was a medium in which a lot of other writers were plowing the same field. It gave me the luxury of not following a lot of footprints and leaving my own footprints in the snow.
It must be a great feeling as a writer or whenever you discover what your idea for the book is and you get excited about that idea and you know you can write a novel about it. It must be very exciting. But at the same time, I would think you'd want to keep it to yourself just in case somebody was going to steal it from you and do it.
But, I never worry about that. No, that's never been a concern for me. The only thing that I fear, two things. One is another writer somewhere else working on the same darn thing I am, and so all of a sudden I'll be 3/4 of the way through a book, and I'll look at, your site or bookreporter.com, and sure enough, somebody else works on the same plot. Or when real life interferes with my books. And what I mean by that is in the Act 1 of Breaking Point, I have this bit of business in which the character Daria is down in Mexico because a rogue element of the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearm Agency has been selling guns illegally to Mexican drug America Trafficante. Mm-hmm. Well, lo and behold, that story really took place. And as we were getting ready to release Breaking Point, this thing with the ATF and Operation Fast and Furious and illegal sales of guns started dominating the news. I thought, oh, good Lord. I had written that a year earlier before that news broke. And so in that instance, I lucked out that real life replicated what I created in fiction. So, and since my books take place in the real time, in the real world, and in real politics, I have to be a little bit careful that the elements that I'm writing about in 1 year don't change radically 9 months or 12 months later and screw up my plot.
Now, you're in Portland. For some reason, there's a lot of writers based near that area. I know John Saul's like in Seattle, or used to be in Seattle. I don't know if he's still there anymore, but... You got Chelsea Kane there, but it seems to be a good spot to write. What is it about that area of the country that writers flock to?
Well, we joke that it's because it's so gray and rainy all the time. What else are you going to do? It's pretty good motivation when it's been raining for 12 days. You're right, though. It's an area in which, first off, I have to say, bookstore owners and bookstore clerks are phenomenally respectful and supportive of Northwest writers. Librarians are phenomenally supportive of us. And then it's a good community for writers, and there's lots of writers here. We have this famous bookstore, Powell's City of Books, which is one of the largest bookstores in the world here.
Right.
And it is a pretty literary and a pretty collegial group of folks up here, and so it's really a fun place to be a writer.
Right. I tried to get an interview with Chelsea Kane last year, and it didn't work out for one reason or another, and I'm still pretty upset about it. But it's not that she doesn't want to do it. I think it's just at the time she was so busy. But maybe you can tell her it's not such a painful process for me to interview.
I'll definitely pass that along, because again, she writes these really horrific and disturbing books, and she's the nicest person in the world. And many a time over a cup of coffee, I said, How does such a nice girl like you write these twisted stories?
Right, and they make her up in her books, and you see her picture in her books, and she almost looks like Elvira from, you know. But I guess that's all, you know, something that the reader has to think, that the author, you know, the reader is supposed to look at the author and think, well, yeah, look at that person. And they're enjoying writing these sick novels, twisted plots and twisted characters, you know. And a female, who would ever write a female Hannibal Lecter? But I mean, she does it so well. But and I remember when I thought Gretchen was gonna it was supposed to be three books, and I thought, oh, no more Gretchen, and they might as well forget the whole thing. Without Gretchen, who do you have? So it's almost I mean, when you have a really great villain, you can't kill them off. What can you do with them?
And I have to, I'm going to disagree just a little bit, because I wouldn't have read all three of those novels if Gretchen was all it was about. I really liked her two protagonists, Archie, the very, very flawed detective.
But don't you think without Gretchen is not the same, though?
It was Archie and Susan that brought me back to the books. You're right. You're absolutely right. She's a great villain, terrific antagonist. And Chelsea's done a brilliant job of bringing her to life. But it was Archie and Susan that bring me back to the next book, because I really like her heroes.
Right. I guess it's me, but I like Gretchen. I'd rather see Gretchen. Without Gretchen, it's not the same. But I'm sure I'm not the only one who feels that way.
I get your point.
I understand where you're coming from, too, because Archie's interesting, too. But Archie's a very troubled character to begin with. And, of course, Gretchen is troubled times a thousand, but I don't even ever want to meet anybody like that.
Heaven forbid.
But I mean, the fun it's like when you're an actor and you get to play a villain. I mean, how much fun must that be? You can really scream at people and, you know, grab them and, you know, scratch them or whatever you're doing as the villain. I mean, how much fun that must be. I mean, every actor tells you how great it is to play a villain.
Absolutely right. Yeah, they are. That's a universal truism of the stage, that the villains are have all the juicy parts, right?
And then as a writer, I guess you would say to yourself, well, what's my villain going to do now? Who can I kill? Who can I really destroy their life? You know, what can I do to my characters? I just
that
can't.
Is the twisted part of this. Yeah, you do think that. You wake up in the morning and think, what evil can I perpetuate today, and how can I make my hero's life harder?
I remember there's a scene, I think it's in the Kiss the Girls, James Patterson's book, Kiss the Girls, back when I was really enjoying the Alex Cross book. But that's a whole other story. But anyway, there's a scene where they're playing Twister to figure out who they're going to kill next. And it's a terrific scene. I mean, it really is effective, because you really believe they're doing this. And you know, I don't know if you've ever read that book, but if you ever get a chance, go back and read that scene. It's hysterical. I mean, that's how they decide who they're going to kill next.
Oh, that's amazing. Okay.
It's a very twisted thing, but it's effective. I mean, it really, really works in your mind. You're like, I can imagine these two doing that, you know, because he's so good at writing these really twisted characters. He's really, really horrible characters, people we hope we never come in contact with.
Well, those characters stay with you, they really do.
There's an author that I interviewed one time, her name's J.A. Jantz, she writes mysteries and thrillers. I guess they're more mysteries, but she actually was picked up a guy along the road one time, and the guy decided he was going to kill her. I mean, he decided, and I don't know how many minutes later, that she was going to die. And she'll tell you the whole story if you ever talk to her, but it's fascinating. I mean, of course, she's still alive now, so no, it didn't happen, but can you imagine?
Yeah, she's another Northwest writer. Yeah, she's a great writer.
Can you imagine, though, coming in contact with a serial killer and having them decide they're going to kill you? I mean, it's horrifying even to contemplate.
Yes, and every now and then as a reporter, I had to cover some court case or some homicide case or a police case in which you ran into actual sociopaths. And just, I spent most of my career writing about, you know, politics, and which I love a great deal. But every now and then I did do, you know, cover courts and cops, and you would run upon a character, and you'd interview this person. You'd just think, boy, there's no soul behind those eyes. That's just something flawed inside this mechanism. And I will admit to you that from time to time I will go back and try and bring back those memories and remind myself of what that was like before I write a scene with a villain.
Right, exactly. I mean, now, like I said, Crashers was terrific. Breaking Point's even more terrific. I can't wait to read your third one, because if they're in this, you know, they're getting better book by book, I can't wait to read the next one.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that a lot.
But because you're definitely growing as a writer, and you're very meticulous. I was reading online some of the way you were describing writing passages and saying they were direct and throwing them out and starting over again and making sure are you a perfectionist?
I'm not. My girlfriend would laugh hysterically at that question because I'm I am a messy person with piles of paper everywhere and I'm not at all a perfectionist.
Well, sounds like you're a perfectionist as far as your writing is concerned, though.
Yes, I'm a couple of things. What I am is I'm highly competitive. Not in the false world. I don't care about sports all that much, and I don't like card games and board games. But when it comes to my writing, I want each scene to be as good as possible. And I will often look at a scene, you know, in paper when I'm just, you know, scratching on it, and I'll write on the side, can be better, can do better. Just it's not quite there. It's not quite the scene I need it to be. And I'm, because of all of my years in journalism, I have a very thick skin. I don't mind throwing out anything to make a scene better. I will rip up any scene and do it over again.
So what would we see you doing other than writing? I mean, how do you get away from your writing? What do you do? Obviously, you go up in planes with your friends. I mean, what else do you do?
I spend a great deal of time reading and seeing movies and loving being in Portland, Oregon. My girlfriend is a novelist, Katie King. She's had one mystery published, a murder mystery.
Oh, cool.
So we compare and contrast each other's works, and we often write together, and we proof each other's works. So we have a great deal of fun doing that.
Well, what happens if you read something of hers and you don't like it? Do you tell her that?
Yes, yeah.
You will?
Yeah, and she will too. I'll find that little note on the side of a scene that says, yeah, this didn't work. It didn't cut it for me. And because I know that she's a real good storyteller and really knows her craft, I will have to tamp down my ego and say, she's probably right.
I was thinking of Stephen King and his wife, who's a writer too, and I mean, obviously, he's so much better than she is. In my mind, I mean, Stephen King, you don't get much better than Stephen King. But, I mean, I'm thinking of him just sitting there saying, well, I write better than you do, if he ever got mad at her, you know. Obviously, I mean, we'd all rather read Stephen King than his wife, but not that she's a bad writer, but I think Stephen King's got an uncanny ability to get into the human psyche. Which,
mm-hmm, right.
Which is very, very rare in an author. I mean, nobody writes like him, let's face it. I mean, never having read Tabitha, I mean, she might be good, but I can't believe she's as good as he is. And if he's listening now, he's probably very angry with me. But be that as it may, it's my opinion, and I am entitled to it, but I don't know why I'm talking about Stephen King. I should be talking to you, but your books are good, and I can't wait to read the Daria ones. Now, how old is Daria, by the way?
She is approximately 34.
And soon to cause lots more trouble, I'm sure, in the two books that you're working on.
And she's a great deal of fun because she is not a long-range planner. She's a person who leaps into scenes and then figures out what's going on after she's leaped. There's a famous bit of dialogue from Aaron Sorkin in which his character, one of his characters said, "I have a two-part plan. First, I'm going to show up, and then we'll see what happens." Well, that encompasses Daria. Daria shows up, and then she sees what happens. And so, unlike the chess-playing type of character or the very cerebral character, she just simply wades in, and you know, whatever comes her way, she deals with it. And so, she's great fun to write. And I'm hoping against hope, knock on wood here, that readers will feel the same way.
And if they do a movie of Crashers or Breaking Point, I hope they do it as a theatrical movie. I wouldn't want them to do a TV movie, a movie of the week kind of thing. I think that wouldn't be as effective. I mean, it would be much more fun to watch these things on the big screen. I'm sure you would agree.
Well, it sure would. It sure would. Wouldn't that be exciting? So,
but do you offer them to Hollywood? I mean, do you have somebody that does that for you, that tries to sell them to Hollywood?
I have a lawyer in Los Angeles whose task it is to represent me there. So far, we don't have any traction on these projects. And if it were to come to pass, I would be thrilled. I would be just so excited. But on the other hand, I'm a working novelist with an editor in New York, and so I'm the happiest guy you ever met. So if Hollywood came about, I would be doing handstands. But until it does,
did you get a crowd? I assume you did a signing at PALS, since you're so close to PALS.
PALS has been very supportive. I got to do signings for both books there. And thank goodness. I mean, they're just wonderful. I love them.
And how many people showed up? Did you get a crowd for both?
We drew 300 people for Crashers.
That's great.
Yeah. We drew 120 or so for the second book. But then again, as my girlfriend Katie King likes to say, it's like your second wedding. You're not going to get the same crowd.
Yeah, but your second book is terrific.
Well, I think so, too.
I think you should have had just as many, if not more, people. But that's just my opinion. I'm a little biased because I really like the books. We wouldn't be talking if I didn't really like the books. Well, what would be the point, you know? You can't interview somebody and say, by the way, I don't like your books, you know? I don't think that would work too well.
we're talking to mediocre authors, so-and-so. Yeah, that would be terrible. Here.
But, I mean, Minotaur, it's his knack for really getting good authors. I don't know what... I mean, I enjoy reading every... I don't think there's ever been an author that Minotaur has published that I haven't enjoyed to some extent. I mean, I'm trying to think of a bad one, and I can't think of one. I can't think of one at all.
When we get together at the World Mystery Convention or the Thriller Festival or the World Mystery Convention, the Minotaur folks look at each other and blush a little bit because we all recognize great editors, great support personnel, great marketing. They're very selective of who they get to be their writers, and we do feel lucky. I mean, we are fortunate indeed to be at that house. I mean, it's just a great house.
You just said when we get together, I thought, oh, he's inviting me to one of these conventions. How cool is that? I totally misunderstood you, but I was excited there for a minute. I thought, wow, how cool of him to invite me. But I mean, someday maybe we will get to meet. I mean, I'm sure you don't get to the East Coast all that often, but maybe you probably get to New York, though.
Yes. Yeah. Thriller Fest is in July in New York City, and I've been there the last 2 years. We'll be there again this year. And then the World Mystery Convention, also known as PAXRCon, floats around the country. So I think
right, and you don't have to necessarily have to have a recurring character to get into these. I mean, your first two books are due, but you know you don't have to have a series.
Nope, not at all. Yeah,
that's great. Well, we've been talking to Dana Haynes about his new book, Breaking Point, which is out from Minotaur Books. It's been a great time. I've really enjoyed this.
This has been fun. Thank you so very much.
Yeah, have a lot of fun. Tell Chelsea Kane it's not so bad after all.
I will pass that along.
And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.